get this straight. If the indictment is... if the indictment is, and I have seen you say this, that crossfire reduces everything, as I said in the intro, to left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left.
Stop.
Why do we have to fight?
Why do you argue?
We're in bad shape, fellas. We need help from the media, and they're hurting us. You're doing theater when you should be doing debate.
You're listening to Under Surveillance, WLEW's biweekly show on popular culture, politics, and the relationship between mass media and public opinion. I'm your host, Kevin Fulham, and every second and fourth Wednesday mornings, I'll be joined by a series of guests as we take a look at everything from the makeup of the Supreme Court to upcoming elections and to how social and political climates impact our view of the future in film and television. Under Surveillance is broadcast on WLEW, a listener-supported community radio. And for more information or to listen to archive shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. If there's one genre of television that seems to be on life support, it's the traditional sitcom. As long-running shows such as Frasier, Everyone Loves Raymond, and Friends have shuffled off the airwaves in recent years, some have commented that the prototypical three-camera sitcom is finally being put out to pasture. Do new approaches to the genre such as The Office and Curb Your Enthusiasm represent the future of television comedy? Will we ever see another sitcom that everybody is watching, like Seinfeld? And where does The Simpsons fall into this discussion? And why the need for a Simpsons film while the show is still on the air? Returning as my guest is Robert Thompson, professor at Syracuse University and the founder of the Center for Television and Popular Culture. That's up next on Under Surveillance. Welcome to another edition of Under Surveillance on WLUW, and today on the show we'll be talking about the evolution and current state of TV sitcoms. There's been some talk in recent years that the traditional sitcom in the style of The Cosby Show or Everyone Loves Raymond is a dying breed, and certainly we've seen the introduction of new styles of comedies such as Curb Your Enthusiasm and The Office. But the format has been a staple of television for 60 years, and this coming Friday will mark the big screen debut of The Simpsons, which wrapped up its 18th season earlier this spring. My name is Kevin Fulham, and returning as my guest today is Bob Thompson, a professor at Syracuse University and founder of the school's Center for the Study of Popular Television. Welcome back to the show, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
So, Bob, before we get to your thoughts on the current state of TV sitcoms, did you believe The Simpsons would succeed when it was first introduced back in 1987?
Well, I did, only because everybody who saw it, even though it took a while for The Simpsons to really kind of find itself and become the really brilliant show it became, but it was pretty quick. First time Bart uttered, "Eat my shorts," underachiever and proud of it. All of the merchandising that accompanied The Simpsons when it first came out, it had an enormous cult following. I'm not sure it would even be called cult. It was so big and was one of the big hits that the new Fox network had. That and Married with Children and 21 Jump Street really helped jumpstart that network.
I think it's funny, you look back at that first wave of Simpsons episodes, that first season, and the animation's very choppy, the characters don't have their voices down. A far cry from what we've seen, certainly even a couple of years later.
Right, it really did have to develop and mature. Of course, they started out on Tracy Ullman's show,
sure.
little shorts, and those are very different than what we would come to see. And I think the other thing was that in the beginning, those first seasons, The Simpsons was clearly about Bart Simpson. I think what The Simpsons figured out a couple of seasons in was that Homer was really the character. And Homer Simpson, I think, is one of the great characters in the history of American storytelling in any medium. This guy who, kind of an every schlub who the world constantly keeps tossing bad things to. He's never smart enough to benefit from any of them. But for the mere promise of a donut, he's willing to get up and fight another day. A really interesting character, and I think by the third season or so, The Simpsons had really begun to find its voice, and then there was a run of many years where I think one could argue without hyperbole that it was the best thing on television.
It's funny how that happens with shows, how the emphasis shifts from one character to another. I mean, I remember when Family Ties was introduced, Meredith Baxter Burney, playing the mother on that show, Elise Keaton, was seen as being the big star. And then a year later, they figured out, well, it's Michael J. Fox.
Exactly. Fonzie on Happy Days, the same deal. He started out on that show. In the pilot episode of Happy Days, he barely utters more than a couple of sentences. He just does this kind of James Dean-like grunt and facial expression. And, of course, by the time that left the air, which it had already fallen into a bizarre Baroque tailspin, Fonzie had, of course, become the star and the breakout character of that show. And, you know, we should remember that TV sitcoms are 60 years old, but the sitcom actually started during the network radio era. Father Knows Best and the Goldbergs and Amos and Andy and Fibber McGee and Molly, there were many, many what we would call situation comedies today, had already gotten their start on radio, and a good number of them, Jack Benny, Burns and Allen, and others, made a transition from TV to radio. So this form actually goes back to Amos and Andy in 1927.
Do you view The Simpsons as a traditional situation comedy?
No, it's certainly got a lot of elements to it, but I think the traditional situation comedy is what we think of as either done live or live on film or live on tape, three cameras, shot in front of an audience who is laughing, or in some cases, a fake audience, which is the laugh track. So Cosby Show, Friends, Seinfeld, Family Ties, Different Strokes, Burns and Allen, those were all sitcoms pretty much performed live, but to tape with an audience listening. I'd also say something like Leave It to Beaver or Father Knows Best were traditional sitcoms, even though those were shot on film, but they had fake laugh tracks going. The Simpsons, for one thing, was clearly not shot three-camera or on film. It's animated, which makes it a completely different kettle of fish, and its structure is nothing like a sitcom either. Because it's animated, it can do anything. I mean, there's absolutely no limitations visually except the limitation of what you can draw. And the other thing that's most important, and I think why it's, one of the many reasons it's been able to survive, is that since it's animated, there is no problem with the aging of characters. I mean, this show has been on for 18 years. If this would have been a live-action sitcom, it would have had to have gone off a long time ago because Bart would have been in his, by this time, late 20s. And we've seen that happen to sitcoms. As you know, you start out with a comedy with a bunch of cute kids and the family is raising them. And, of course, the kids get older and they get clunkier. And the reasons for the whole thing to exist disappear as the dynamics of the age of the family change. And Cosby would try to, and others would try to keep things going by continually introducing new kids. The Simpsons has never had to age. Bart looks pretty much the same now as he did by about season three or so. They're all the same age, so they've never had to worry about the show essentially outgrowing itself. And I think that's been a great advantage to them.
Why do we see the Simpsons film coming out now? Why the need for a Simpsons film? Certainly we've had reinventions of TV series. You know, last time I talked to you, we talked about the Miami Vice movie. But why the need for a Simpsons film while the show is still running?
That wasn't the first one either. South Park also did a movie version fairly early in its run, and that was a pretty good movie, too, if you like South Park. I mean, it was vulgar and all the rest of it, but they did a movie while they were still running and are still running now. I think I'm actually not surprised that The Simpsons is doing a movie. I'm surprised at what took them so long. I mean, here you had this universe, the Simpson universe that was created, which has really penetrated now a generation or two of people's experience. My students don't remember a world where there was no Simpson. They've been watching this since their consciousness has kicked in. And because of its dedicated following, because of the fact that it really was a successful and good show, I'm surprised this thing didn't come to the big screen a long time ago. Now, in many ways, the question is, what can The Simpsons really do as a movie that it's not already doing better or has done better as a television show? You know, we've had all of these episodes that have played. Now it's just going to be something that's going to be able to be a bit longer. There's nothing about the big screen that the Simpsons really needs. It works fine on a 19-inch television set. And there's also going to be the temptation to go to this movie thinking it's going to be or expecting it's going to be the best Simpsons you ever saw. And we could probably get to 100 really classic, perfect, meticulously done, really funny Simpsons episodes. And it's going to be really hard after all this time to make this movie live up to its greatest episodes, which, of course, we can in some markets see three times a day in reruns.
Yeah, and exactly. And with a film like South Park, certainly the ability to make it R-rated and to include some of the profanity and the vulgarity and just the adult nature to really go to the wall as far as what you could do, and you couldn't do that on Comedy Central. So certainly I can see the appeal there. But with The Simpsons, you're not going to see a graphic portrayal. You're not going to see Homer cursing up a storm, you know. So, yeah, so exactly. You know, what could they do there that they couldn't do during the television show?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, the thing about South Park is it was able to go a lot further in the spirit that it was already in. The Simpsons is not going to want to betray its identity. Bart using that kind of language would really be uncomfortable, kind of thing. We would not want to see it. It's not what Bart does. So there is really nothing that this movie, short of being a longer episode, that is going to do anything, or can do anything for that matter, that the TV show can't already do, and maybe that's why it's taken them so long to try this. I think one of the reasons it's coming out now is that it's clear that The Simpsons is not what it used to be. Still, I think, in a bad episode, better than most of the other comedies on the air at the best, but it's getting a little long in the tooth, and I think this movie may be the opportunity to, one, maybe inject a little juice into The Simpsons again. It's getting a lot of attention. The quickie marts that were opened across the country to promote the film itself, I think, will probably get a lot of buzz. It kind of puts The Simpsons back on the top of the cultural conversation again. And this is probably a good time to do it, because I think it's pretty clear that The Simpsons is not going to go another 18.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm joined today by Bob Thompson, who is a professor at Syracuse University and also the director of the School Center for the Study of Popular Television. And today we're talking about TV sitcoms, we're talking about the evolution and the current state of a sitcom format. You mentioned just a few seconds ago that even a bad episode of The Simpsons is still much better than most of the sitcoms that we have running today. And I recently read a transcript of the appearance you made on CNN a couple of years ago where you're talking about sitcoms, and you stated that you didn't feel that the format was dead, just simply going through a dry spell at that time. Do you still feel that way today?
Well, I still do, but I have to say I'm getting a little less confident in stating it. I mean, people have said the sitcom is dead many, many times before. The most obvious was right before The Cosby Show came out, very end of the 70s, first years of the 1980s. There were weeks where there wasn't a single sitcom in the top 10. And back then, before reality TV and before a lot of the news magazines and stuff, that was really an unusual situation. And if you go back and read the feature stories and newspapers back then, you can find hundreds of daily papers declaring the death of the sitcom. And then Cosby came out, was an enormous hit. It turned things like Cheers and Family Ties and other shows that were already on the air but failing into huge hits by becoming part of a lineup. And after Cosby debuted, the sitcom went through probably one of its most profitable and healthy periods of all time. Cosby, Family Ties, A Different World, Night Court, Cheers, Seinfeld, Friends, Mad About You, Will and Grace, Frasier. I mean, these are, you know, sitcoms that are going to be playing in reruns in perpetuity, not to mention some of the kind of anti-sitcoms like Roseanne and Married with Children and that kind of thing. So when the sitcom really fell on hard times, which was with the consecutive endings of Seinfeld, Friends, Will and Grace, Frasier, that all started dropping like tenpins, it just seemed like we were, again, at another one of those periods where some other genres were dominating for a while, reality TV and that kind of thing, and that it was going to be back. And I still think it is. The comedy is now going to have to share the time with these filmed comedies like The Office, like Curb Your Enthusiasm, like Sex and the City, like Arrested Development, a really good comedy that didn't last very long, which are not done in the three-camera style with audience laughing. But for people who say this, we don't want to watch sitcoms anymore, they're not relevant to the 21st century, they forget that right up to the ending of Friends, that was still a huge hit, consistently number one, number two, or number three in the ratings. I don't think it's that we don't want to watch traditional sitcoms anymore. I think there's just not that many out there that are worth watching. And it shows that we still have an appetite for them. A really kind of mediocre sitcom like Two and a Half Men, which is still the traditional type, has spent most of its existence in the top 10 of the Nielsen ratings, showing that if you put something that's even the least bit competent that's a traditional sitcom, and I would say that's how I would define Two and a Half Men. You can get a top 10 audience to watch it. If suddenly, next fall, regular traditional sitcoms that were as good as Seinfeld and Friends and Will and Grace and Frasier hit the air, I am convinced that they would be shooting up to the top 10, and they'd be beating Survivor, and they'd be beating some of these other moribund reality shows. They wouldn't beat American Idol, but then again, people healing us of disease wouldn't beat America.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Seinfeld, and I don't know whether you're a fan of Curb Your Enthusiasm or not. It's the HBO Larry David show. Seeing that show, or watching that show over the past 5 years, it seems that even Seinfeld pales in comparison. I mean, Larry David is just a genius. The show is almost completely improvised as well. I mean, they have plot points that they're running through in each episode, but as far as the dialogue goes, entirely improvised. Is that unprecedented for a television, for any television show? I mean, for television sitcom especially.
You mean the improvisation?
The improvisation, yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm a little suspicious as to how much that's actually improvised. I think we're kind of led to believe that they turn those cameras on with the most modest of a paragraph of a plot line, and everybody's up there pulling that stuff right out of their hats and their sleeves. My guess is that most of the people who arrive at the set when they shoot that have got a pretty good idea of what they're going to improvise. But, you know, that's hard to tell. But that having been said, I don't want to downplay the quality of that show. It is a brilliant show. It is nothing like the traditional sitcoms we've seen in the past. It is really funny, and I think on some level it really has trumped its predecessor, Seinfeld, because of that improvisation or pseudo-improvisation and the subject matter they can do, the fact that it's on pay cable, and the fact that they don't have to have 22 of them every year that they keep churning out. So it is a lot of that stuff, like The Office and like Curb Your Enthusiasm, are able to go places that sitcoms never were. But sometimes you're kind of in the mood for a sitcom. Curb Your Enthusiasm is a great show, but it's kind of painful to watch sometimes.
I mean, it's cringe comedy. It's what I like to call, cringe comedy. Yeah.
Exactly. It's like, no, you're not going to do that. You're not going to do it. Oh, you did it kind of thing. I mean, it's really good, high-quality stuff, but it's a different experience than if you go back to the traditional sitcoms. And I would call it Seinfeld, for all of its innovations, was a pretty traditional sitcom. Friends, those kinds of things that we remember from must-see TV on Thursday night, they were so easy to watch. It's why they do so well during the dinner hour in reruns. You don't have to be in the room. You can be doing your homework or making dinner or talking on the phone. That busy time between about, 5:30 and 7, where the sitcoms all play in reruns, they're perfectly made for that because they're just so easy. I would defy anybody, even if you've never seen an episode of Friends in your life, to step into the middle of an episode. You wouldn't even have to watch the beginning. Step in halfway through, watch 2 minutes, and I defy you to remain confused. It's impossible. It shows they're so self-evident. They're so easy to watch. Sitcoms can be enjoyed comatose if you had to. And I think there is always going to be a demand for that kind of extremely user-friendly TV because, let's face it, there are the shows like Curb Your Enthusiasm, The Sopranos, whatever, where we take the phone off the hook, turn off the lights, and we watch the thing from beginning to end. But about 80% of the TV viewing that we often do from the other room. The TV is kind of on, and we're doing other things, and I think the sitcom is still just what the doctor ordered for that type of viewing.
You mentioned before one advantage that Curb Your Enthusiasm has, besides being on HBO, is the fact that they only have to do 10 episodes for an entire season as opposed to, say, 22 on network TV. And with the BBC Office, before it traveled across the Atlantic and settled here, you had 6 episodes in each year. It was on for 2 seasons. You had 12 total episodes and then a couple specials later on. And Ricky Gervais has been quoted as saying, you know, I have no idea how people in network TV do this. You know, I have a certain number of ideas, and that's basically it.
It's absolutely true, and there's both an advantage and a disadvantage. I mean, it is incredible. And forget 22 episodes was the model that started working around about the 1980s. If you go back to the 60s, those sitcoms were producing 39 episodes per year, 39 new episodes, and then there'd be a 13-week either rerun or summer series put in. So things like Green Acres, which was a brilliant, brilliant sitcom, was doing, I think theirs was a 32-episode season. It is incredible that they churned that kind of stuff out. So Curb Your Enthusiasm types of shows have got the advantage that they can really concentrate on a much smaller number of episodes. The disadvantage, however, is one of the things that made sitcoms so that we embraced them was because they were on constantly. You really came to know these characters. They became part of your life. And that's why when things like Friends went off the air, there were some people who were really bummed out. You know, these were people that they had actually spent more time with than their real friends. And some of the old evergreen classics, like The Andy Griffith Show, so many episodes, so many years, allows you to kind of create a texture of a place and a development of character in a way that gives it a kind of density that these much shorter season series never are able to achieve.
With a show like The Office, have we seen other successful television series make that British to American transition?
Yeah. Some of the biggest. All in the Family, which is tied with Cosby as being the only show that was number one 5 seasons in a row in the ratings, was based on a British sitcom called Till Death Us Do Part. Now, Norman Lear changed it really dramatically, but it was still based on that. Sanford and Son was based on Steptoe and Son, also a British comedy. Three's Company, a huge hit, is based on a thing called Man About the House. In their first couple of seasons, they took the script and directly reshot them with an American cast and an American audience, which is why in Three's Company, notice how they never go to the bar, they go to the pub. They didn't even bother to change that. So, yes, there have been a lot of very successful shows that have come from British comedies. Also been a lot of failures. Coupling was a big hit in the U.K., we tried it a couple of years ago here, and it was a dismal failure.
Well, Coupling also was supposed to be a takeoff on Friends, right? Friends turned into Coupling,
exactly.
Turned into something else here back in America. That was interesting.
Right, precisely. It's like rock and roll. It starts here, goes over there, comes back in the form of the British invasion. In this case, the invasion didn't work very well. And there were not one, but two adaptations of Fawlty Towers, a brilliant British comedy. One was starring Bea Arthur from Maud and Golden Girls. It was called Amanda's by the Sea. She was in the John Cleese role, and the other starred John Larroquette from Night Court. Both of those were such pale reflections of the original, and none of them did any good either.
What do you see as the largest stylistic differences between British and American sitcoms?
Well, I think the biggest stylistic difference is they talk like British people, which is something that if you're a PBS viewer, you're completely used to, but there's always been the sense that we can't show those on network TV, which is why whenever we tend to discover a British sitcom, there's a feeling that you've got to do it with American actors or it's going to sound too much like Masterpiece Theater and people aren't going to watch that. I'm not sure that's necessarily true, especially in this age of cable where people are more than used to seeing that kind of stuff. But that was the first big thing, is they figured that Americans had to be in it. It's also got a very different kind of look. The exteriors in British sitcoms are always on film. The interiors are done on videotape. You can notice that kind of difference. In the past, there had been a pacing that was a little bit slower, though I think the UK has caught up with us there. And then the big difference is that the series tend to be limited. You will do a series of Absolutely Fabulous, and then it'll be over. And if it was really popular, they might do a second series, and then it's over. Or they might do a third, but there isn't this idea that in the U.S., since all the money is made in syndication, the idea is you want to start a series and keep the thing going for as long as you possibly can, but at least 100 episodes so you can sell it into a good 5-day-a-week syndication package. Most of the British comedies have not had that need to just keep going and going and going. And, of course, some of our sitcoms in the 8th, 9th, 10th year have gotten absolutely ridiculous. Happy Days, by the time it went off the air, was one of the most bizarre things because it had completely lost all of the definition of what it was. But it kept getting good numbers, and the more episodes, the more money you make in the back end.
And Happy Days coined the phrase, jump the shark, with Fonzie in one of the episodes.
I mean, a perfect show for that to have been coined on.
And I remember even Work from Ork, Robin Williams making an early appearance on one of those shows as well, Happy Days.
Right. They used that show. Gary Marshall, who was the executive producer, used his hit shows to spin others off. He introduced Mork, who went on to Mork and Mindy, and Laverne and Shirley were introduced there as well, who went on to their own series, and they actually started scoring higher than Happy Days in the late 70s. It was Laverne and Shirley number 1, Happy Days number 2, Mork and Mindy number 3.
Joni Loves Chachi, much, much further down on the list.
Right. Well, actually, that was a big hit when it first
came. Oh, really? Okay.
It didn't last long, but it burned brightly for a short period, believe it or not. Yeah, it's hard to believe that that's now become one of the, whenever you want to make a joke about a bad show, Joni Loves Chachi is the perfect one to pull out of your pocket. But that show was actually in the top five.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and I've been joined here today by Bob Thompson, who is a professor at Syracuse University. And we've been talking about the evolution of TV sitcoms. We just have a few minutes left, and I want to ask you whether you think that we'll see another sitcom that everyone is watching, like a Seinfeld, like a show where you have the finale for a particular show and the whole country is tuned in. Not that we won't see another show as good as Seinfeld, but whether people's entertainment tastes are just so splintered with the internet, with cable, and whether we'll still have programs which we'll rally around and gather around as a community.
Well, that's a really good question. And I don't think it's the internet so much. The internet is the ultimate in fragmentation. But there are people who, you know, they have their time on the internet and they watch some video on the internet and whatever, but then they also watch TV. TV viewing has not gone down nearly as much as we would have expected with the arrival of the internet. As a matter of fact, in the past couple of years, what's gone up? I think cable is what really did change this. As cable began to, more and more channels, more and more fragmentation, certain people watching the HBO comedies, kids can now watch Hannah Montana and that kind of stuff on Disney Channel. The idea of a show like The Cosby Show, something for the entire family comedy, is going to be really hard to pull off now. The kids are going to watch stuff they like better because it's made for them on Disney or wherever, and the adults are going to watch stuff that's made for them that's better on HBO. I think pulling off another thing like The Cosby Show is going to be really, really difficult to do. Friends and Seinfeld, however, could happen next season. All you need is good writing, good casting, characters people want to watch. If something exactly like Friends, no more modern, no more innovative, but as good as Friends was, debuted in the fall, I am almost certain it would be in the top three by the end of the season, or at least the second season when people had discovered it. So, yeah, I think it's that could happen again. I mean, look at the biggest hit on the air right now is American Idol. For all of the fragmentation of the audience, especially when it comes to music, which is more fragmented than anything, for all of the internet, for all of this, American Idol is based on a show that started on CBS Radio in 1934 and went on television with another host throughout the 1950s. So the biggest hit on the air we've got right now seems to defy any possibility of success in a fragmented era. It's about pop music, and music tastes are divided. It's an old-fashioned genre, and by gosh, it plows everything else in its wake. Put on a show just like Friends or Seinfeld, just as good as those, and you'd have a hit, I have no doubt about it.
I think the rise of HBO has really, it certainly changed the way that I view television. You know, it's very difficult for me to watch network television again now after seeing what can be done with shows like Deadwood, shows like The Wire and Sopranos and Curb Your Enthusiasm.
That is the thing. I mean, HBO is still, even with the end of The Sopranos and all that, it's still the most exciting place for art on television. It took the idea of the television series and just brought it to this completely different place. However, let's remember that HBO learned that from the networks. When the networks were finally reinvigorating TV art with Hill Street Blues and St. Elsewhere and 30-something and Moonlighting, HBO was still experimenting with the stupidest series. Remember a thing called First and Ten?
That's right, and Arliss, I think, as well, too, right?
Well, yeah, that was a little later, but and that wasn't quite as bad. But First and Ten was just hideous. Delta Burke was the owner of the football team. The Hitchhiker they played, which was like a poor man's Twilight Zone. It wasn't until HBO took a look at what the networks were doing with some of that highbrow stuff of the 1980s that they then started saying, wow, we could do that, and we could do it even better. And I think their first breakthrough was Tanner 88 that Robert Altman and Gary Trudeau did, and then the Larry Sanders Show, and then, of course, Oz and The Wire and The Sopranos and Sex and the City and 6 Feet Under and Deadwood. I mean, just one masterpiece after another. But they learned that from the network. They just have a business model where they can trump the networks every time.
On that note, we're going to wrap it up here. My name is Kevin Fulham, and I've been joined today by Bob Thompson, who is a professor at Syracuse University. Bob, once again, thank you very much for coming back on the show. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Pleasure was mine. Thank you.
For Robert Thompson, my name is Kevin Fulham, and you've been listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW. For more information or to listen to archived shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. That's www.undersurveillance.org.